I want to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We have one case set for oral argument. I understand that the lawyers have checked in. And before we get started, I'll introduce the panel that we have. To my left, we have visiting Judge Justice Ruben Gonzalez. To my right is Justice Dana Womack, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. So with that, I will ask the clerk to call the court, the case. Thank you very much.
May it please the court. I'm Scott Lindsay. I represent Crescent Interest, LLC, which I'm not going to get too deep into the facts right off, but they own a gas station slash barbecue restaurant along 377 in Crescent. It's been barbecue on the Brazos, then it was Rooster's Barbecue, which is the Beans, the Appleys here were running that restaurant, and now it's back to barbecue on the Brazos. I think that the evidence is disputed in many, many ways that was presented to the trial court about who owns what property, what the value of that property
is. Counsel, before you get any further, that I've got just sort of a general question. I think that we were all dismayed to see on the docket sheet that nobody thought that mediation was going to be warranted in this court, in this case. So I'm just sort of curious why we're here, why y'all haven't been able to work anything out.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I won't disclose conversations, but I will say that Mr. Selheimer and I have had conversations over a period of time, and we, even despite the amount of money in the case, we have tried, and we didn't get anywhere. So here we are on a $20,000 case. All of this time later, talking about, broken and damaged property. But the case was not decided on those grounds, on how much it was worth or who damaged what. It was decided on, procedural grounds, where every single objection was sustained. Then the no evidence summary judgment was granted. But why did that happen? COVID-19, but I am not here asking you for a judges, we had a pandemic, and therefore you should get rid of all of the deadlines. That is not this case at all.
Are you aware of any cases where COVID or something similar has been used to as a grounds for reversal of a trial court's essential lack of a good cause?
Well, we don't have a lot of litigation over it. What we do have litigation for, short answer is no, Your Honor, but we don't have a lot of litigation. What litigation we do tends to be what shows up in the Beans brief, which is really generic. My office was closed, and therefore I shouldn't have to meet a deadline, right? And we do have those cases. There are quite a few of those. There's at least one from this court. I have not seen any case that has anywhere the level of the detail of the sworn evidence that was presented in this case, pandemic or not, that says this was good cause or even lack of unfair surprise, as we talk about in our brief. But I know the court has read the briefs, but this COVID hit Ms. Lumley, Ms. Vaughn now, I know her Ms. Lumley, but it hit hard. It hit her. It took her months to recover. It hit every employee in her office. It hit every person in her household. That's the sworn evidence before the court. But no quarter, and all of that evidence was stricken and summary judgment granted. So here we are. Now, I will say there is no substantive response actually to the summary judgment grounds. I think the procedural posture of the case is that if this evidence should have come in, then we've got fact issues across the board, and I think we've established that as well. But let me talk about unfair surprise first. We have established, and Mr. Bean's affidavit says he has the property that we're talking about. He says it's his. We say it's not, but that's what trials are for, right? But he has the very property that they say they are supposedly surprised by. Actually, let me correct that. They don't give the court any specific reason that they are surprised. I understand it's my burden. I do under 193.6 because our evidence was excluded. But we met that burden. We said they have the property, and when you have a witness who you already know about, you don't get to claim unfair surprise. When you have evidence that you already know about, you don't get to claim unfair surprise. And we met the, I think we have met that standard in this case, and it's not been refuted. And of course, as pointed out in our reply brief, the version of surprise that is argued is extremely technical. It does have case law to back it up, but it is case law that this court has recognized is no longer the standard, that it's good cause only when the rule 215.1, I believe at the time, prior to the 99 rewrite of the rules, at that time, unfair surprise was not a part of the rule. It was within a good cause, and the cases said further that unfair surprise alone was not good cause.
But that was in the context of Rule 215 sanctions?
Well, actually, Your Honor, back before the 99 rule changes, the Alvarado case, the Sharp case, I believe, that's cited, Rule 215 back then, as I'm understanding it, I had to pull the quote from the cases, but the rule spoke to this a good cause for the admission of evidence. It was one among the sanctions that a trial court could order to exclude the evidence, and that good cause was one of those. Good cause was required to get your evidence admitted. Right.
Do you disagree with the notion that now the rule makes it mandatory to exclude unless the party trying to get the evidence in shows carries
the
burden?
No, that's what 193.6, I'm not dyslexic, but I do that all the time. No, that's what the rule says. It's out unless. Now, of course, we believe that we've shown that in spades here. And one of the points that the Beans made, it's a fair point. Why are my cases all things that affirm, right, or affirm and say that evidence was admitted and that's fine? Well, practically, my experience of being in trial courts, and I know this panel has trial judges and former trial judges, my experience is when people come to court with good reasons, trial judges understand those good reasons, and then that issue doesn't make it to the appellate court. It just, when you have this level of evidence, it just doesn't show up very often in the Southwest Thirds and soon to be Southwest Fourths.
Of course, we're supposed to defer to the trial court's rulings on evidentiary matters if there's a legitimate basis for it, correct?
Don't disagree again, Your Honor, but at the same time, we have uncontroverted evidence, and I still stand by that it's uncontroverted. We have two different sets of evidence. We talk about what happened starting in November moving forward, and the Beans want to talk about what happened before November, and they really don't overlap. There's a little bit of disagreement about the scope of Ms. Lumley's affidavit of how long she was down, but that's it. There are no fact issues in my mind for this court to have to defer to Judge Walton, it was Judge Walton at the time. Of course, he's not on the bench any longer. Yes, typically you do, but that's usually when there's some disputed fact issue. And when we look at what's an abuse of discretion, it's a failure to follow, you know, established rules and precedent. I'm not getting that quite right. But when we have undisputed evidence and clear rules that are out, then that's what rises to an abuse of discretion. And particularly in a case where, you know, we're not here asking for, and we weren't asking Judge Walton for three or four chances. This isn't the same car wreck case where we're back and forth, oh, I'm sorry, I still haven't done it, I'm sorry, I still haven't done it. This was one deadline missed for good reasons, regrettably, but for good reasons, and yet here we are, we're out. And that just shouldn't be the standard, and it can't be the standard. I do want to talk just a moment about this. Actually, let me give the court a couple of examples of good cause cases, others that are out there. These are not in my brief, but comparing, you know, getting ready for today. Good cause allows for the introduction of evidence in difficult or impossible circumstances. That's the Pop Cap Games case out of Dallas, 350 Southwest 3rd, 699. But two specific examples. One, I'm a little surprised that this case is out there, but it is. It's called Last versus Quail Valley. It's a 2010 case out of Houston. And it says counsel had the documents. Counsel had the documents in their office, and they misplaced them. And the day before trial, they found them. And they immediately produced them when they found them. And that Court of Appeals, Last versus Quail Valley, said that was good. That was good cause.
What's the citation on that?
I have a Lexis, Your Honor, but it's 2010 TexEp Lexis 2303. Another is a Broyhill case out of Dallas 2013, and it was there more explainable. Attorney left the law firm and was going to be the attorney fee expert. And it was good. That was good cause to allow them to switch out the experts at the last minute. That's another one I'm surprised was disputed, but it was. But I bring those cases up to say we know, and the case law says, mistake of counsel, inadvertence of counsel alone is not good enough. We know that. I'm not here to try to tell this court otherwise. But when we look at the case law. The case law says we're a whole lot closer to that end of the spectrum than we are to the impossible. I'm so sorry that you and everyone that you know was sick and affected for months at a time before we'll find a good cause for the admission of your evidence. I want to spend a little bit of time on the DWGK case because I think this is it's a parental rights termination case out of Texarkana relatively recently, and it's prominently featured in the Beans brief. That case, it's distinguishable on its facts, as I say in my brief. But I found more in getting ready for argument. Footnote 5 of that case expresses no opinion on how Rule 193.6 would be interpreted in any other kind of civil case. So I had mentioned in my brief that it limits itself to parental rights termination cases, but it goes even further and expresses no opinion. And on page 685 of that opinion, that it even speaks of, given the fundamental liberty interest at stake in those kinds of cases, the good faith effort must especially be implied. Okay, now let me talk about that good faith standard. I think to some extent, I don't agree that it should be called good faith, but there is a standard in 193.5 that comes right before it that you're supposed to make a full response at the time that they're due. Don't disagree with that. But we take it too far when we start calling that good faith, or that we then somehow say that if you didn't have good faith at the initial responses, that we're now going to take away your ability to rely on 193.6 later should that need arise. I think it gets the standards reversed, and importantly, I think it would create law, but it would foster, to me, litigation over who had good faith when they initially answered or not, when those words don't appear anywhere within the rules. If that is somehow an exception that you don't get to rely on 193.6, then that's not something that should be allowed, or that I think an intermediate court ought to create such a rule. But really, 193.6 presumes, and this kind of goes back to unfair surprise a little bit, but also for this good faith thing, 193.6 presumes that something was done untimely. That's when the rule takes over, is either a deadline was missed or discovery has closed or something. So if we're going to, we can't look backwards to the beginning and then just ignore 193.6 or rewrite it. Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, I think we've all probably read the part of your brief where you distinguish that case. I did want to give you a little bit of time. I think we'd like to hear you talk about your issue 3 on the attorney's fees that were awarded to the appellees.
Yes. So there was a counterclaim for fees as, prevailing party under the contract essentially is the standard we're talking about. After we had all of our evidence excluded under as not timely produced under the discovery deadline, we then moved for summary, no evidence, summary judgment, and said, I mean, we expressly said, we're using the same objection they used. And that time, the different trial judge, but that time, no one asked for a continuance, but then it was continued, as 193.6C talks about. That's what I don't want to concede that he did, that the judge did it correctly. He says I'm standing here as appellant, but at the same time, that's the exercise of discretion. Now, before he did that, the preservation of error issue, invited error, he did rule. He denied our summary judgment. Denying our summary judgment can only happen if the objection to all of that evidence was overruled. And that because we asked to exclude all of the invoices, all of the testimony, and then that was denied. Because if those had been sustained, that had to be granted. So that was preserved in my mind. And then secondly, particularly, not that we want to craft rules for smaller cases, but we cannot have a standard, in my opinion, where cases like this that had such, in my opinion, a fundamental issue that we can't then get on to the Court of Appeals, or otherwise we would have to go through a jury trial just to then be able to get here. So we should be allowed to make those agreements and move on. And my time is up, so I'll have
Thank
a seat.
You. Thank you. Thank you very much.
May it please the court. Edwin Silheimer from Granbury, Texas. I'm pleased to be here today representing Donald Rooster Bean and his wife Lori Bean, who are the defendants below. It's also my privilege in this case to come to defend the rulings that case law specifically commits to the sound discretion of the presiding judge, who in this case was the Honorable Ralph H. Walton, Jr., and to explain why his decisions do not equal an abuse of discretion, despite complaints and attacks from the appellant that they do. The fact that a judge of a different court, or even a reviewing appellate judge, might have ruled differently on a matter does not mean that abuse of discretion has occurred. Case law commits to the sound discretion of the trial judge, exclusion of evidence under Rule 193, denial or granting relief under Texas emergency temporary orders, continuances, matters related to discovery, and evidentiary matters.
So you wouldn't agree with the sort of tacit argument, it's not so tacit, that the COVID pandemic sort of didn't change the rules, obviously, but you don't see that provides any sort of good cause for not fully responding
to this? I don't believe it does. I don't believe it does in this case, and I'll address that in a moment, Justice Kerr. What I do want to say is that we're here today reviewing Judge Walton's decisions because of the actions of the appellant, in that they chose to file their suit in Judge Walton's court, a court where he had been the district judge for more than 20 years and was a known commodity on the bench. They had concurrent jurisdiction in the county court at law. There are other jurisdictions available, but we're here reviewing Judge Walton's decisions because that's the court that they placed us in. We're also here in talking about the effects of COVID on litigation because the plaintiff decided to file their suit during the pandemic, only 60 days after the alleged eviction.
Well, that's
occurred.
Not like filing a lawsuit the first day that you've been diagnosed with COVID.
No, but I believe we were already on the 27th emergency order at the time this suit was filed. So the fact that an attorney who was filing a lawsuit and pursuing litigation should be going in it with their eyes wide open, that there are going to be some special problems that they file a suit in the middle of a pandemic. And, you know, the pandemic applied and affects not only the plaintiff, but the pandemic affects the defendant, too. The big difference is that the plaintiff gets to decide when they file their litigation. The defendant has no choice of when they have to respond. And the rules of civil procedure give the plaintiff the option to non-suit their case at any time, an option that the defendant doesn't have in a pandemic in this case. I think the case law is clear that a decision by the trial court constitutes an abuse of discretion only when it is arbitrary or without reference to any guiding principles. That's the Downer versus Aqua Marine case. When a trial judge is guided by the rules of civil procedure and is faithful to their provisions, there is no abuse of discretion. And that is what has occurred here. The rules of civil procedure are clear with the obligations imposed on a party to make discovery. In this case, we have a 180-day discovery period from the time that was when they initiated the first discovery. On behalf of my client, we propounded discovery I believe it was the day after we filed an answer in the case. And at that time, there were still 157 days left in the discovery period. The plaintiff in this case was obligated to make a full and complete response to the discovery based on all information available to them within 30 days under the rules. As you look at my brief, we set forth the response that they actually made within 30 days. Interrogatories to be supplemented. That is in no way a complete and full response. When you fail to make a complete and full response, the rules also impose upon you an obligation to amend that answer reasonably, promptly. And the discovery rule also requires that you supplement that answer and you complete discovery during the discovery period. The appellant and the plaintiff did none of that. Their original answer, her affidavit says that she was first diagnosed with COVID 20 days after the original answers to discovery was due. That left her with over 107 days from the date that she got discovery to amend or supplement her answers. She didn't do any of that. And Rule 193 applies to all three situations: the failure to make discovery, the failure to amend, and the failure to supplement. In this case, Rule 193.6, the exclusionary rule, is automatic and it's mandatory unless the trial court finds that one of the exceptions exist. And the burden of persuasion on the trial court under the rules is specifically placed on the party who would seek to admit the evidence that should be excluded. In this case, they did not convince Judge Walton, did not secure a finding from Judge Walton that there was good, that there was either good cause or unfair surprise. And yet they're here today asking this court to ignore that failure on their part and find that Judge Walton somehow abused his discretion by applying the actual exclusionary rule under 193.6.
Well, so talk to us a minute about the appellant's, goose versus gander argument on their third issue about your attorney's fees.
Yes, Your Honor. The I disagree with him that if the trial judge, under the summary judgment evidence before the trial judge, there was evidence that I believe would allow the trial judge to find that there was at least some evidence to avoid a no-evidence summary judgment of attorney's fees. We're talking about a non-jury matter involving contractual attorney's fees, what the law allows the court to take judicial notice, basically, and determine reasonable attorney's fees on its own motion.
So do you think that Ruhr, I'm just curious, did Ruhrmost Ventures change that idea at all of a court's being able to take judicial notice of fees in the absence of the particulars that that case walked through?
I don't know that that's been addressed, and I don't have an answer. I don't have an answer to that question. But the summary judgment evidence that we have was not just my itemized statement, Your Honor, and my billing. First of all, I was fully disclosed under previous case law as an expert witness. I had disclosed my name. I had produced a resume. I had stated that my testimony would be at an hourly rate of $250 an hour. And in fact, at the trial, when we had the summary judgment evidence, I basically presented that I had not reviewed my time and billing to determine what an hourly rate was until the summary judgment was filed the day before, and I produced my time and billing sheets the next day. But what was also produced that I don't think was excluded from the evidence was my client's affidavit that he had hired an attorney, that he had contracted to pay an attorney, and attached to my affidavit there was a contractual attorney's fees affidavit that basically stated there was a minimum fee incurred upon filing an answer, and the court was well aware that an answer had been filed. So even though I may not have been able to sustain my support my evidence of attorney's fees on my traditional motion seeking attorney's fees, I believe there was plenty of evidence before the court that would have avoided a no evidence summary judgment, contrary to what his position was there. I don't think we have to establish an exact amount to avoid a no evidence summary judgment. I think we have to only establish that there is some evidence that reasonable attorney's fees were incurred and recoverable. Now, that being said, I just don't understand how we can have a Rule 11 agreement that says we will agree to ask the trial judge to enter a final order denying a no evidence summary judgment that the plaintiff filed, overruling plaintiff's objections to defendant summary judgment evidence, and granting defendant second summary judgment, and file that with the court and get the court to sign that order, and then have an appellate come here and say those exact three things or error by the trial court that should require reversal.
Well, didn't the Rule 11 agreement also expressly reserve the right to make any appellate arguments?
I don't. It says, entering into this stipulation, plaintiff in no way waives any arguments or appellate contentions of any kind relating to any other matter other than the reasonableness and necessity of attorney's fees. And it goes on to basically say the things my understanding of the rule were set forth in 1 and 2, which is what they're complaining of now. The trial judge actually denied my traditional motion for summary judgment, which means that we were still and denied the no evidence motion for summary judgment orally. And that meant that we were set for trial on the issue of jury trials, and ordered me to submit to a deposition, in which I agreed to do, on attorney's fees prior to trial, to address that issue prior to trial. And that's exactly what the estate of Tormina case indicates an appropriate action for the judge to do.
I've got a question. I'm a little confused by something you said earlier on issue number 3. Are you saying that it's appropriate for the trial judge to take judicial notice of attorney's fees in the context of him granting a traditional motion for summary judgment? Is that what you're saying?
Similar. I believe that he could have taken judicial notice in considering a no evidence summary judgment as to whether attorney's fees had been incurred.
Do you have any authority about a judge taking judicial notice about attorney's fees in the context of either a no evidence or a traditional motion for summary judgment?
I believe that was addressed. I'm not sure if that was addressed in my brief or not, but it's part of the, I believe it's part of the, I want to say it's chapter 38 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, but that provides for recovery of attorney's fees and contractual matters. I may have to get that and submit that post submission, Your Honor, on that particular issue. The point that I was going to also make about the fact that the plaintiff or appellant in this case did not secure a finding of that one of those exceptions under Rule 193 applied, and yet seeks reversal of that, as far as I know, is without authority. Certainly there is no case law cited by the appellant or any that I'm aware of. In fact, I'm not aware of any case law on 193.6 in which a exclusion of evidence under 193.6 has been held to be an abuse of discretion. Certainly, there's one case cited by the appellant, the In re DW case, for the that admitting evidence that should have been excluded can be an abuse of discretion under 193. But I know of no case in which an appellate court or reviewing court gets to substitute or has been approved to substitute its opinion or its decision making as to whether it was persuaded by the appellant's proof as to the existence of good cause or lack of surprise that would warrant reversal. And I, quite frankly, I don't know what that standard of proof would be, whether it be that it would have to be as a matter of law that it wasn't established, because clearly the rule puts it in the trial court and the person seeking it to get a finding from the trial court, and says the burden of establishing that is with the party seeking to enter the evidence that would otherwise be automatically excluded. The other point that I think is is important to make on that sort of on that similar discussion is that, and I'm the proof that they were making, the argument that they made to the judge, which apparently they were relying upon here, was, gee, you're not entitled to any of our discovery, and it doesn't matter to your preparation for the case or to you because you have possession of the property. That I find that a little unbelievable, and also I don't believe that Judge Walton found that to be a credible excuse of showing lack of surprise. It almost seemed like to me that if you're suing a bank, you say we don't need to tell you anything about why we want money from you because you have the money already. I mean, that's not a basis for showing lack of surprise. And in this case,
well, but the beans have admitted that they took the oven and the refrigerator
they vacated the property, Your Honor, and they took items that they had bought during their tenancy there. They took items that the previous landlord had given to them. They took their inventory. They took a lot of matters. They took what belongs to them. What we didn't know is we knew, and this is in their summary judgment response, we knew what our ownership of the property was. We knew how we acquired ownership of the property. What we didn't know is how the new owner, how he allegedly acquired any ownership of property that the previous owner had given us. Which property they claimed he owned? Did he have a bill of sale? Did he have an itemized inventory list? What was he alleging this property was worth, or what condition was it in? If there was a bailment contract, where is the bailment contract? We didn't have any of that information. And the fact that we had property that we owned doesn't give us any insight as to what their claims were.
Thank you, Counselor. Your time's up. Rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. One thing about that initial discovery response, COVID hit Ms. Lumley 2 weeks after those initial discovery responses. And then the next 107 days that the Beans want to talk about is the same 107 days that Ms. Lumley was out and all of her people were sick.
Do you disagree that the initial responses lacked a little something?
They lacked, but here's one thing about that. Again, that's 193.5, not 193.6, but and as the court is well aware, any opinion that comes from this court applies to every case, whether it's 100,000 documents that are out there or whether it's 250 documents or 40 documents. And, sometimes we've got 10, 20,000 documents. It's just not possible to get out the door in that period of time. And there are other circumstances. Also, it was the middle of the pandemic in October of 2020. And then, of course, Ms. Lumley at that point then was diagnosed. I'm sure Ms. Lumley would like to take it back and be a little more detailed about that. But then we've more than met our burden. And in fact, the Bean standard, I pretty much heard him say it's an impossible standard, but I'm struggling for what else we would have had to offer.
I wanted to ask you about that because it is an interesting question. I mean, if a trial court excludes evidence under 193.6, what does the affected party have to show to get that reversed?
Well, you know, Your Honor, trial counsel standing up and saying, swearing under oath, that I got very sick and everyone around me got very sick and I had employees in and out of the hospital and I lost dozens of days, I don't want to overstate the affidavit, dozens of days of work, of working. If that's not good cause, I don't know what we're doing here. I don't. We have to at some point have a pursuit of justice, right? That's what all of the rules are about. I looked it up. Black's Law Dictionary says justice is the fair and proper administration of laws. The laws exist, but 193.6 is kind of the catch-all from when there have been mistakes or sicknesses. Then that's when 193.6 steps in. Webster says that justice is conforming to principles or ideals. Well, then it's interesting, though, because then you read what's an abuse of discretion right after you read what is justice. And an abuse of discretion is arbitrarily or unreasonably failing to follow guiding rules and standards. We have rules.
But we don't have any guiding rules and standards about what level of illness or your office being affected. I mean, it's not like we can point to something, can we, and say this crosses the line and this doesn't?
Not necessarily. I don't have some case that I can point the court to that says, you know, 7 or 8 weeks with COVID is good cause, and you know, 3 weeks with COVID is not. But I can tell you that there is I'm going to forget the name, but one of the three cases that's cited in our brief granted multiple extensions of a medical expert report deadline where the counsel got sick once in August. And it was still allowed and affirmed later on appeal after there was an extension in September and October and all the way out into, I believe, even February of 2020. That was good cause. That was a standard that was used. So I don't know what would have to be proved. We went to Judge Walton first and said, I stood there and I argued that, and I said, Judge, we haven't offered a single piece of new evidence to you, but this is a relatively small case, so we are here asking for reconsideration. And at that time, trial was not until November 1st when that hearing happened. And that was denied in addition to the other two, in spite of all of this sworn testimony and the lack of unfair surprise. So I'm struggling that at some point, yes, mistakes can be made, but this should not be a standard where someone was sick and did not recover and all of her employees are going to the hospital and back and everyone in her house is sick and all of a sudden she's having to call her carrier, because that's not good cause under 193.6. It's good cause when a lawyer leaves a firm to switch out an expert. It's good cause when counsel lost some papers. She was sick. And what we're doing is attacking her for not explaining every single minute of every day. That's good cause, Your Honors. And issue three, you don't reach if you reverse on issues one and two.
Thank you very much. Your case is now submitted. I will say that we would certainly entertain a request for post-submission mediation. If y'all decide you want to do that, I would encourage you to consider doing that before we rule. But, of course, that's up to you. We can't make you. But I think it would be a good idea in this case. So, with that, your case is submitted, and you're free to go about your day. Thank you.